This is episode one of The Other Ganges. In this episode, beginnings. An early-ish history of coastal BC, internal conflicts, and introductions. Hi, I'm Renita. I'm a journalist, a student, and a child of two very different immigrant families. I want to tell you one story, built out of the stories of many. It's a history, a story of change and staying the same, a story of the land. In some ways, it's a story about all of us, me and you and everyone else. But first and foremost, it's a story about a little island off the coast of British Columbia and the people who have made a life there. It's a story about Ganges. Not that Ganges, though. There's another one. Did you know that? It's the largest town on that windy, thickly forested island. It's not named after the original Ganges. Not directly, anyway. It's actually named after a ship. The truth is often much more complicated and multi-layered than you'd expect. I'd like to take you with me to Salt Spring Island, a member of the Gulf Islands that line the coast of BC. My father's family lived there during the 1960s and 70s, after emigrating from Germany. His stories about life on the island caught my imagination every time I heard them. I always tell him he should write a book. But of course, the history of Salt Spring doesn't belong to just one person or just one community. It's known now as many things: an artistic hub, a historic home of psychedelic music and hippie culture, and by some, another example of how community can be fractured by the very people trying to hold it together. I'm not from the island myself. I grew up nestled into the suburbs of mainland BC. But now I'm all grown up, tucked far away from the BC coast in Montreal, and I'm able to take a closer look. Like the rest of the country, Salt Spring Island is patched together out of many different stories, built on a framework made up of still more. All of the lands in this region are the ancestral homes and unceded territories of a number of indigenous peoples: Tsawwassen, Cowichan, Saanich, Chemainus, Tsawwut, Coast Salish. They had lived here for thousands of years before the tides of European colonizers began to arrive. To some, the bay bordering the island is still known as Wuaqum, gathering place of the merganser ducks in the Cowichan language. This is a vast, deeply important, and deeply painful story, and as I myself am an outsider to the island and to its indigenous culture, I am not the one to tell it. But no story from this country should be told without knowledge of the context upon which it stands.
You'll hear bits and pieces of the island's indigenous history over the course of these episodes, and I'll touch on a particular story from this history in our final installment. but I really think that these stories deserve dedicated work on their own, with more detail and focus than I can give in this broader piece. Also, a quick note on the language you'll hear in this episode. I've chosen not to edit or alter the language used by the interviewees you hear. Some of them use words that are dated or no longer in use, particularly terms used to refer to certain cultural or racial communities. I've done this in order to preserve the stories that they're telling in their own emotional language and from their perspective, especially since they're speaking about their own relatives' experiences. But I also think it's helpful to provide a slight language warning here, just so you can be aware of hearing outdated terminology when and if it occurs. Okay, now, back to my intro.
The current iteration of Salt Spring is a community made up of immigrants. Each time I visited, I came with no questions pre-prepared. I just wanted to hear whatever my interviewees wanted to share with me, to piece together whatever narrative they wished to bring forward. What the people on the island had to say echoed across the decades, from before the 1900s, and it rings true even today. Even for me, when I go back to my apartment in Montreal, far from the ocean.
We all fell in love with nature.
When I started this project, I had a preset, achievable goal set for my research. In keeping with my father's tales of the island, I wanted to talk to other people whose families had immigrated to Salt Spring between the 1960s and the 1980s, or those who had clear memories of what the culture was like there at that time. I spoke to members of my family, to old friends of my dad. I expanded my reach with word-of-mouth recommendations, emails, and Facebook posts. I even reached out to the Gulf Islands newspaper, The Driftwood, and spoke to paper editor Gail Suberg about my project. Each person I spoke to gave me a whole different set of perspectives. Some reached out to me because they saw my last name and remembered parts of their own history. Some found me out of a desire to preserve some of the archival work they had been doing for decades. Some I sought out myself on the recommendation of others. Predictably, the scope of my research grew and changed as I sunk more and more into it. The stories I heard led me in directions I hadn't considered before, and new narratives came to light.
Han said he remembers Wilf sitting in the pub talking about how Salt Spring should just secede from Canada and be an independent island.
Everyone I spoke to helped me build a map of the island of sorts. I formed an image of Salt Spring chronologically, geographically, and sonically. I'd like to show you what I found. I hope that what you hear will build the same maps for you. But before we get too far ahead of ourselves, let's start at the beginning.
Token recording of me getting into a car. I'm a journalist.
Sort of. A beginning, anyway.
Do you hear any better impression?
I just said I can't find the butter man. Or campfire veteran.
I like campfire veteran.
Since every story is made up of many stories, layered on top of and around each other, I want to invite you along with me on my various trips to Salt Spring Island during the creation of this project. As we get to know some of the people who live here and hear their stories, I want you to get to know me. A little bit, anyway.
That's the bus.
Yep.
Community shuttle.
The first time I came to Salt Spring to record interviews, it had probably been 10 years since my last visit to the island. It seemed fitting to take the journey with my family, since family is a big part of the reason for this project. My dad drove us around the main roads, uncovering old family homes and showing us the buildings my grandfather had built that still stand. The four of us, my German-Canadian father, my Indo-Singaporean Canadian mother, and my brother and I in all of our second-generation glory, listened to Pearl Jam on the radio and imagined what all these spaces would have been like 10, 20, 50, 100 years ago.
Harbor House Hotel. I remember you playing
there.
At the Harbor House?
Nice place.
It is now. It used to be a dive. And that's where we exist, the main club there.
There it is.
And that's where I'd like to start our storytelling.
All right. About to talk to Darlene Horrocks. Just get her number.
Funnily enough, the person I spoke with the oldest family history on Salt Spring, was the last recording I made at the end of my third trip to the island in 2019. I was put in touch with Darlene Horrocks after speaking to another family historian and multi-generational islander who played music with my dad back in the glory days. Bless a musician's network. Also, you're definitely going to want to hear about the Salt Spring Island creative scene of the 1960s and 70s. Oh boy. More on that later.
Hello.
Hi, Darlene. It's Renita.
Hi.
Darlene was very sweet and extremely well-informed, even if she was a little nervous to record a phone interview. I huddled up in a corner room with the doors and windows shut tight and listened to her explaining a part of island history that honestly surprised me when I first heard about it.
And then I know the other side of your family has been on Salt Spring since like before the 1900s, right?
They were part of a group of blacks that came up from California to Victoria. They had been invited by the governor. BC was needing more inhabitants, or it was going to end up being part of the United States. And so the governor had put out an invitation for more population. And so anyway, these blacks in California had traveled across America on the Oregon Trail, a lot of them, because they were looking for gold in California. But when they got to California, the laws about, you know, retrieving your former slaves weren't, and them being able to vote and have all those kinds of rights like regular Americans, weren't happening for them, and so they were looking for elsewhere. Mm-hmm. And, it was Governor Douglas who inquired about them emigrating to Vancouver Island. And so in 1859, of those people that were in Victoria, the blacks in Victoria, 13 or so, with and without families, preempted land on Salt Spring Island. And so that's how I ended up having, a story about the island.
This is not the origin story of settlement on Salt Spring Island that I expected. You see, my impression of the island growing up was decidedly Eurocentric. Most of the families I saw mentioned again and again as families of influence on the island were European. German, Dutch, English, you get the picture. My own family is part of the wave of Germans who arrived in Canada during and after the Second World War. You don't see much evidence of this particular slice of history on the island today.
No, there certainly aren't any of our black families not there anymore. But there were some until... maybe 10 years ago or so, that had gone to the States, moved back, descendants of the Stark Estes family.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, through all that, I have, you know, connections with the Howard Estes, Sylvia Stark family, and the Gwynn family. They came from, Clay County, Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
And my Wims family, they came from Missouri. And some of the Wims married another early family, the Sampsons. He was the first constable. He was English, and he had married a First Nations lady. So through that side, my great-great-grandmother's from Cooper Island.
When those families sort of lived on the island historically, do you know, was it like a particular region of the island where they were living, or was it kind of, because I know Salt Spring was kind of divided between, like, you know, the north and south parts of the island.
Yeah, there was the north end and the south end.
Yeah.
It seemed a lot of the black settlers were in the north end, and others, you know, were in the south end. Isabella area, Point area, you know, the Kanakas, the Hawaiians were there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there were settlements all in Fulford Valley, Burgoyne Valley, and the northern parts of the island. Mm-hmm. The whole Fernwood area, it was called Biggs mm-hmm. Settlement, I think, at the time. And so, yeah, there were a lot of people there. There's roads named after them and whatnot. Yeah, and it was, you know, there weren't very many people on the island, and so they didn't have time to deal with much racism. They needed each other to survive, really.
She mentioned it only briefly, but Darlene touched on another piece of Salt Spring history that defined the island in early settlement days, the Hawaiian population. Yet another story I didn't expect. Maybe I'm hyper interested in hearing stories of mixed heritage because I myself am of mixed heritage. Or maybe it's because I think it's a good lens through which to get a glance at the quote-unquote Canadian story, whatever that may be. But I definitely wanted to know more about this. Music is an intrinsic part of my dad's family experience growing up, and of mine and my brother's. My father, Arno, grew up playing music and passed it on to his children. Growing up, we heard tale upon tale of his time gigging in bands on Salt Spring and elsewhere, ranging in wildness depending on how old we were at the time of the telling. Some of the most beloved tales revolved around the island bands and the bandmates he created truly inventive low-budget performances with. These music stories led me to the Roland family as soon as I began research on this project. Not only were the Rolands fellow musicians and friends of my father's family, they're also dedicated to preserving their family history, and that family history takes place across decades on Salt Spring. Kate Roland was the one who got me in touch with Darlene. She and her brother Dave sat around a dining room table with me and none other than their old bandmate, my dad.
All right, Salt Spring. Well, they started off close to Salt Spring on Portland Island, which is just out the mouth of Fulford Harbour. My great-grandfather, William Noel Cunnah, preempted land there in 1875. Our grandmother was born on Portland Island. All the rest of his daughters were born on San Juan Island. So when they moved north, once they put in the border between the States and British, he brought his daughters with him, and our grandmother was born here at Portland Island. When she was of school age, they were going to school at Beaver Point, so they would row over to go to school, and it was sort of on again, off again, depending on weather and if they could get there. So they planned to move to Salt Spring, is what the story was. But when I look back at the timeline, it looks more like my grandmother moved here to Salt Spring when her son was needed to open the school at Isabella Point. And that was in the early 1900s. So the time they moved here is sort of like a question now, because I thought, well, if they moved here when she was a young girl, that would have been, she was born 1877, so it would have been maybe the 1880s, somewhere in there. But I know for sure they moved, they were here in 1902, I think, is when they opened the Isabella Point School. And so she moved her children to where David lives now, at Isabella Point. Her father, our great-grandfather William Nalcana, was in his 90s by then, and he lived out his final years at Fulford Harbor there, close to his daughter. She started built her home there. Then she married Peter Rowland, still stayed at the same property and had 9 children. One of our father was the 13th of her 16 children. So I guess we arrived here very early in the 1900s.
Main Island and at the Springwater Lodge there, and she said when the herring went through when she was a little girl, I mean real little girl, and she, it sounded like there was a storm. It was so loud, just the roar of the fish boiling in the water. Great-grandpa was on the coast earlier, wasn't he, or is it?
He was on the coast, but that was before there was a border. It was Oregon Territory there. It was not BC. It was not the United States. It was an area they called... I don't know who came up with the name Oregon Territory, but someone decided that that's what it was. And it involved, or it included, most of BC, all of Washington, some of Idaho and Montana, Oregon, and Northern California. So it was a huge area that the British and the Americans were fighting over. Well, not fighting so much as they all wanted control over it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he came, that was the great-great-grandfather, John Cox Nalcana. They called him John Cox because the story was he looked like one of the sailors on the ship when they were traveling. So they called him John Cox, but his name was Nalcana. Hawaiians and Indians back then had one name. They didn't have a surname and a given name, which caused problems with a lot of the record keeping. But he came as Nalcana with the fur traders. They landed at the mouth of the Columbia River and built a fort called Astoria. That was for a guy named John Jacob Astor.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah.
He would have been, what,
1811, they arrived there. John Jacob Astor, he had his company that was the Pacific Fur Company, I think? It was all about the fur trade back then.
Yeah.
Everybody was after fur for trade, and he wanted to be one of the first ones on the coast. He wanted to beat out the Northwest Fur Company, definitely beat out the Hudson's Bay Company. Mm-hmm. So let's get out there and build this fort. And when they sailed around from New York, around the bottom of the, like I guess went right around Cape Horn at the time, out to Hawaii, and that was a provisional port at that time. And they picked up fresh water and fruit and what have you. And they asked King Kamehameha the First, who was ruling then, if they could use some of those manpower. Can we use some of your people to help us navigate? They were great navigators, the Hawaiians. Navigate across the way and help build this fort. So they struck a deal, and Nalcana sent about 24 people, 24 men. Oops, sorry. And our great-great-grandfather was one of them. So they landed and built Fort Astoria. So he was the first on this coast, but it wasn't to Salt Spring. I don't think he ever made it to Salt Spring. Back then, it was there was nobody here except for the indigenous people. There was it wasn't open for preemption and homesteading until 1850s.
Yeah, you could do a whole story just on the first guy.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
John Cox, he went all the way to England and back. He did. A few that survived the whole adventure. Most of them died of colds and things like that.
Smallpox, measles and things. He went, John Cox went from Fort Astoria, he landed there in May of 1811. And by June, they had the fort built. And then they, he was still with Astor's group, John Jacob Astor's group, but they started going up the Columbia River, and then they crossed paths with the British guy, what was his name, David Thompson.
Thompson, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And so they traded people, and Thompson took the big Hawaiian guy to help him with the, you know, pulling the canoes up the rivers and traveling, and he was they loved his humor and whatnot. So he took him, and they went right across to Fort William, which is Thunder Bay. Like, wow. I can't, what did they walk? You know, like they didn't jump on a plane or get the train.
Yeah,
portage.
Yeah. The rivers, mostly on the canoes, but a lot of it would be against the current.
Exactly.
Yeah, so they went all across there. And then he climbed on a ship, I think, I'd have to look. I think it was the Phoebe was the name of the ship. And they sailed, I guess, through the Great Lakes out the St. Lawrence Seaway into England. And then he left England. It was the war was happening around here. 1812 is when he headed back. The British were putting pressure on the Americans at Fort Astoria because they wanted that fort. So they thought, well, we better get back and defend our property. So getting back, they have to leave England, come across the Atlantic, down around the Horn, back out and back to the West Coast. So he did all that in a few years. By 1814, I think he was back on the coast here. And that's when his contract was up. They had 3-year contracts. So he went back to Hawaii. And then I think he came back. They would come back and forth, but it was these 3-year increments. And because they were gone for 3 years, and they raised families. They hooked up with the native women. The guys running the forts, the British and the Scottish, and the, you know, there was a handful of Europeans that were the bosses, and everybody else was either indigenous people here or their hired hands. But they wanted them marrying into the native communities around surrounding the fort, because these are the people that are showing them how to live through the winter, how to figure out that weather and how to salt fish and all these things that they didn't know. So they said, go out and make nice with the local people. And so they raised families. And then 3 years later, their contract's up, they're shipping them home. So, you know, a lot of them left them behind, just, and they were absorbed back into the reservations or their own native communities. A lot of them came back. And when it was finally allowed for them to stay, many of them did. Because in Hawaii at that time, it was not so great. You know, by the 1820s, the missionaries were there. Hawaiians were dying on the beaches by the tens of thousands from smallpox and things like that. Yeah, they were really getting wiped out badly. So the guys over here are going, well, I don't want to go back to that. I'm gainfully employed. I'm making money. I got a family. You know, so I'm kind of thinking that's one of the big reasons why so many of them stayed.
Yeah.
And that's where we came in. John Cox now kind of had his son here. Now, it's debatable whether William Naukana was born here or born in Hawaii. Any records taken of him, and they're sparse. Some of them say he was born in Honolulu. Some don't say at all. But he could not read or write. Any paperwork that we find of his has an X on it, and they would mark this is his X. The Hawaiians could read and write. In the 1800s, early 1800s, the king made sure of that, and his queen, Kaʻahumanu, she said, "No, our people are going to learn to read and write. They're going to school."
That's amazing.
Yeah. So if he was born in Hawaii and raised as a young man there, a child, he surely would have learned to read and write. But he came, he did not know. His daughters did not read and write. So I think they were born here. They lived here. Mm-hmm. So he was probably born of a First Nations woman and John Cox Naokana. Naokana was his name. Our guy's name was William Naokana. Naming practices with the Hawaiians and the indigenous people, you often took your father's name. Like, it's not as if there's the Naokana name and there's hundreds of them, like Smith and Jones, or even us, Rollins. I don't see anybody else in the records with the name Naokana. He took his father's name and that was that. If he had other children, they would have been given another name, probably another family name, but not Naokana. And when they started taking records, well, what's your name? My name's Naokana. Well, they couldn't spell that. How they came up with some of the things they did, I don't know. Naokana, at least you'd say N-O-A-K-A-N-A. But anyway, so they changed his name and they said, well, what's your first name? And he's, I'm sure he was sort of like, my name's Naokana. Well, no, you got to have a first name. Well, you know, so I can imagine that conversation. They probably just said, well, we'll call you William. So he became William Naokana. They arbitrarily gave you a name, you know, especially if it was a given name. Well, we'll call you this. Lots of Marys. If you look into the censuses and the baptisms of that era, the 1800s, early 1900s, you'll see woman after woman after woman. Her name is Mary. Mary, Mary, Mary. And that last name, unknown. So they just called them Mary. Mary or Anna.
Yeah, we run into dead ends all the time because a lot of the women were Native women, and it just says, you know, so-and-so married an Indian woman. That's the end of the trail right there. It's like,
I found baptisms for William Naokana, and there was one that just says she was, the mother was Aboriginal. One says she was a savage. One gave just a first name, said Cecile. And then there's some that sort of went, there was one that was Cecilia Thomas. Cecilia was spelled different, but where did they come up with Thomas? You know, so it was just, so I don't know if he had six or seven wives in just the time I know him, or if they were all the same person, because it could be one Native woman that they called whatever they wanted to call her.
And there's just no, like, yeah, there's no way to corroborate anything.
No way to know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that was a long way to get back to when we first came to Salt Spring.
It's great, though.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the groundwork.
Yeah.
Exactly. You have to have that context.
Yeah.
Darlene and the Rollins both kept track of as many of the different facets of their family histories as possible. Of course, after the Starks and the Howards and the so-called John Cox arrived on the coast of BC, more settlers were soon to follow.
That side of the family has been in Canada for quite a long time, right?
Yeah, since 1667. Two brothers arrived in Quebec and established themselves along the St. Lawrence River. Mm-hmm. They had left Normandy and come to Quebec. And what else can I tell you? Well, they mostly stayed in Quebec and some went to the States, but the one brother, he stayed in Quebec quite a while, but then eventually some of his family moved west to Saskatchewan and settled in a little town there. And it was originally called Lally's Siding, because one of the daughters' name was Lily, and then it got changed to Marcotte Siding, because it was a railroad siding there, and then eventually it got changed to Howell, and then finally it was changed to Prudhomme, because it was mostly a French community, and that was, I think, a bishop who had been there, or a priest who had been there. The these two brothers, when they came to Quebec, they were among those men who married Fille de Roy, daughters of the king. They each married one of those ladies. Those ladies had come out to the New World. They were sent to New France by the king. They arrived in 1670. That was the first ship. And they had 15 days to find a spouse and marry. And they arrived with goods worth 200 pounds and a gift from the king of 100 pounds. One of the sons that went out, and like we're talking eight generations later or something, one of the sons that went out to Saskatoon was my grandfather. He was from a family of nine, and his father was married to Carolyn Bonday, and her family had come out from around Grenoble.
Okay.
So I have family that's from the west side of France and family from the southeast of France. They stayed in Prudhomme, and my dad was from a family of nine, and then their father died in 1931 in the Depression area.
Mm-hmm.
And of that family, my father's oldest sister stayed in Saskatchewan, but two of his brothers had moved out to Salt Spring in 1942, and another daughter had moved out in the late 40s, and then my dad moved out after the war, and another brother of his had moved out to Vancouver in 1943. And then their mother and the youngest son moved out to Salt Spring Island at that point. Okay. So they've been there since the early 40s, after having, you know, started out way back when.
Great-grandfather William Nullconna, I think I have some papers of his that says he was immigrated, the immigration papers. So the deal is when they left, when they put the border through, it was 1872, they finally drew the border through these islands, the Gulf Islands and the San Juan Islands.
The Pig War, you ever heard of the Pig War?
Mm-hmm.
Vaguely, yeah. Mm-hmm.
We had some relatives involved in that,
because
we were all living on the same islands.
Yeah.
It was some German... They got some German prince to draw the line that the
Americans
Wilhelm. And the Brits were arguing about.
That's right, yeah.
It was Tsar Wilhelm. The British wanted all of the islands and Vancouver Island for Britain. And, of course, the Americans said, well, why don't we draw the border up around...
5440.
Yeah.
There you go. Yeah.
And so they said, no. So... The 49th parallel went through without a hitch in 1846, and it took 30 years, almost 30 years for them to finally decide where this border was going to weave through these islands. And so our great-grandfather was living on San Juan Island at the time, working and living there, and it landed up on the American side of the border. So the time of history at that point, too, was not so good in the States. Like, Manifest Destiny had kicked in. They were coming across that country, just taking everything, because they said it was bound to be theirs anyway. The Hawaiians, what was the guy's name? Thurston or Thurlow or Trutcher, or something. I can't remember the name. But he decided...
That's a bit of ground.
Yeah. It began with a T.
Narrows it down.
I'll have to find out what that was. But he said, okay, well, you people can stay here, but you're not going to live on San Juan Island. You take your half-breed kids and your Indian wives and go to the reserve or something. We can put you up room there, and you can stay in the States. But you're not going to own land here, and we don't really want you, but you can stay. Mm-hmm. And that's when James Douglas, he was working out of Fort Victoria here. And he said, well, you know, if you guys want to move across, now that there's a border here, if you want to move across, we will open up homestead land for you, preemption, they called it. We'll let you preempt land, and after 5 years, if you improve it, you can become a naturalized citizen, and you'll be a member of the British Empire. So that's how
he... That's when he came to Portland.
Yeah, he came up here. They got his... preempted his first land there, and built his home, had our granddaughter, and became a naturalized citizen. So that's where it started for us here. And then we've always just been here. When they moved to Salt Spring, David still lives in the same property.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't move far. All our stories are from right here, homegrown.
Oh yeah. Do you remember which year Hopa built that building?
75, 76.
The picture I have of the island's earlier history, as told by Darlene, Kate, and David, leaves me with some vivid impressions and also with the beginnings of an idea of the character of Salt Spring. I also have some questions that may or may not be answered as I continue journeying around the island's winding roads. How did Salt Spring come to change from its origins as a multi-ethnic land stewardship-based community to the artist's colony version of the land that exists today? I can already feel the deep connection the residents here have to the land itself in Darlene's tales of her ancestors' struggles to arrive here, and in Kate and David's recollections of fishing for their dinners. How has this relationship human to land been forced to change in the wake of modernization, tourism, climate change? What does it mean to be an immigrant to this place, and who claims that term? Luckily, there's still time to consider these questions, and perhaps even more as we move forward through the years and hear stories from more perspectives. We still have several visits to Salt Spring planned. I hope you'll join me.
That's it? That's Ganges?
That's it. That's Ganges, yeah.
I know, it's grown that much.
Yeah. And there's the old high school. That's the middle school.
On the next episode of The Other Ganges, the island moves forward into the mid-20th century, logging, longshoremen, and living off the land.
It was just a comprehensive.
I'll say it's by the sea.